are Locked On Timberwolves, your daily Minnesota Timberwolves podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network.
Hello and welcome to the Locked On Wolves podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day. My name is Ben Beacon. I'm the host of Locked On Wolves. Happy Friday, everybody. I trust everyone has had a great week and is gearing up for a restful weekend. The weather here in Oklahoma City is supposed to be beautiful, so if that's the case where you are as well, I'd encourage you to get out and about, get some fresh air, all while safely distancing, of course. Today, we're going to briefly touch on the Adrian Wojnarowski report regarding a potential restart to the NBA season. Then we'll dive back into our series of the best moments in Minnesota Timberwolves history. Again, this is another network-wide series, and after talking about the most memorable games by individual players on Monday and the best overall games in Wolves history on Tuesday, we're going to talk about the best off-the-court moments in Timberwolves history today. Admittedly, it can be a little bit convoluted deciding what counts as an off-the-court moment, but we'll talk through the criteria a little bit here before we really get into that. So first, a quick reminder to subscribe to this podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, Google Podcasts, wherever you get your podcasts, and follow us on Twitter at Locked On T-Wolves. That's at Locked On T-Wolves. Don't forget the T. All right, so before we get into the countdown, I wanted to quickly talk about Woj's piece on ESPN.com that came out on Thursday evening, I guess. Basically, the cliff notes of this are that the NBA remains, quote, optimistic about the season continuing, even with some potential further delay here. Obviously, it's not about to restart as it's now May 1st, and Adam Silver had previously said he would not make a decision before May 1st. Obviously, he's not going to make an announcement today, but there's several plans out there. There's a report that there's a consideration for playing at the Disney ESPN's Wide World of Sports at Disney in Orlando and basically quarantining teams there. Also, Las Vegas is pitching to do that with both the NBA and the WNBA at some of their hotels at surrounding the MGM Grand. And obviously, they have plenty of courts there. They host the Summer League. So there's several different possibilities. None would include fans in the stands, and some might even include just robotic cameras and no actual camera operators. And even TV analysts calling the games remotely, which, of course, is something that happened like 60 years ago. There is a little bit of precedent for it. Basically they would include traveling parties of under 35 peoples. And, the biggest logistical hurdle here, of course, is the testing. Adam Silver has said that he will not allow the league to come back until tests are more widely available across the country. According to this article, and this isn't something that Silver said publicly, but Silver has insisted that he won't let players even get a test unless they're showing symptoms to this point to make sure that the general public has enough tests. And some of the perceptions, of course, that happened early on with entire teams getting tested before the general public could get tests. So Silver wants to wait until tests are more widely available if they're going to play the rest of the regular season in the playoffs. The estimate by the league is reportedly that it could take over 15,000 tests to complete this season. And so it seems like we're a little ways away from tests being that widely available, which is crazy because we're now like almost 2 months into this, but or a month and a half, I guess. But at any rate, that seems to be the biggest hurdle. Logistically, as long as they can get the players to agree to essentially isolate themselves for a period of time, looks like they could make this work. It's a little bit different than what baseball is trying to do, in that baseball has 162 games to play, or you know, even if it's not the full 162, which I guess at this point it won't be, but if it's 100, it still becomes a little bit more complicated to quarantine entire players and staffs and families for a full season versus 5 to 7 games plus playoffs, and who knows exactly what that looks like. Maybe teams like the Wolves that aren't in playoff contention don't play, or maybe the playoffs look very differently. Maybe there's a tournament of sorts. There's all different kinds of things that have been thrown about. But at any rate, this is an interesting report. It's encouraging that there's apparently multiple high-level executives in the league that are optimistic, and the other word that was used was encouraged. So that's a good sign, and definitely something to keep an eye on. Hopefully, it sounds like there's movement towards, you know, players, coaches, organizations want to have a little bit of closure on this. Is this still something to hold out hope for, or is it not going to happen at all? And so I think because of that, because of the pressure, Adam Silver is going to have to make a decision at some point and just make a call on what's best. Woj has a quote from a general manager in the league that says, quote, "It's hard to lead by consensus in a crisis," meaning that Silver may just have to make a decision as commissioner, and that's what everybody's going to live with based on all the information. And to this point in Silver's tenure as commissioner, he clearly has done a good job of showing decision-making skills in situations, obviously nothing quite like this, but has levied decisions that he's levied have tended to made a lot of sense. So don't be surprised if that's what ends up happening here. All right, transitioning into our list of the top off the court moments in Timberwolves history. This is really difficult. First of all, to really think of many of them. And then once they started to come, then it was ranking them and deciding, you know, is this going to be a top 10 or a top five? What I decided to do is a top five that are, to me, are a pretty clear top five. And then another basically five or six that could have fit into a top 10, but I would have struggled to rank some of them because they're pretty different. So pretty much my criteria is that it's an off the court moment. It's something that was significant at the time in Timberwolves history for the fan base. It felt significant. It felt like a seminal moment in Wolves history at that moment in time. And then some of them, looking back on it, on them, they still ring true. And that's why they were ranked higher. So for honorable mention, I included the inaugural season. Obviously, the first season in a franchise history is a big deal. Also, the Wolves set the attendance record playing in the Metrodome. So they had a game against the Lakers that had nearly 50,000 fans at the game. And so the Wolves were able to set an attendance record because of, well, the interest in professional basketball returning to Minnesota, and then also playing in the Metrodome. And the Timberwolves were able to draw massive crowds that first year. So that hits an honorable mention list. Also, Kevin Garnett won the All-Star MVP in 2003. Technically, that's on the court. So that's, I guess, one of the reasons why it didn't make the top five. And then also it wasn't a real game. But he had 37 points, 9 rebounds, 5 assists, and a double overtime win for the Western Conference, and won the All-Star Game MVP in 2003, which, of course, then led into that summer, though Timberwolves acquired Sam Cassell and Latrell Sprewell. If you want to count that, we could put that in the top five. I had a tough time with it because it's two separate transactions. They, of course, acquired them in different deals. And it's tough to kind of label that an off-court moment. It would be one thing if it was one massive trade. So I went ahead and put that in honorable mention category. Additionally, Rick Adelman's introduction as head coach during the lockout in 2011 leading into 2012. At the moment, this was the Timberwolves coming out of this Kurt Rambis era, and just this kind of, like, you know, David Kahn was still in charge, and so that's what made this a little bit weird. But basically, the Wolves were getting a bona fide, you know, Hall of Fame type coach who had nearly 1,000 wins at the time, had been to the playoffs almost every year in his career. You know, of course, had coached the Kings to the conference finals a couple of times, including when they lost to the, or excuse me, to this, and they lost the Wolves in the semifinals in 2004. But that was kind of a moment that it felt like the Wolves were headed back onto the map. Kevin Love, Ricky Rubio was going to come over, which we'll talk about in a minute. And to get a coach that was a legitimate, you know, Hall of Fame worthy coach, one of the winningest coaches in NBA history, really felt like the Wolves were going to be taken seriously and going to be put on the map by that move. Of course, it didn't exactly turn out ideally for the Timberwolves. There were a lot of injuries, other things, the lockout, several things that caused the Wolves to not make the playoffs with Adelman as coach, but that was kind of the start of a little bit of a return to respect, and certainly felt like a big deal at the time. The jury's still out on the D'Angelo Russell acquisition, of course, but this is also the first time the Timberwolves have acquired a second All-Star to shore up their team and to really give them what should be a big two. And that seemed crazy at first, but I started thinking about it. Sam Cassell came to the Wolves before he'd ever made an All-Star game. He did with the Wolves. Latrell Sprewell was 3 years past his All-Star year with the New York Knicks, and he was like 32 when he came to the Wolves. Wally Szczerbiak became a one-time All-Star as a Timberwolf, but he was already on the Wolves and only made the team one time. Andrew Wiggins, of course, was the number one pick, never made an All-Star game. That was really exciting when they traded for the current number one pick. Jeff Teague was an All-Star before coming to the Wolves, but it was 3 years before he came to the Timberwolves. Jimmy Butler would be the only example, but he came to the Wolves before they had an All-Star. Karl Anthony Towns had not made an All-Star team yet, so the Wolves were acquiring Jimmy Butler, a perennial All-Star, and Jeff Teague, who had been one 3 years prior. So that would probably be the closest thing, but throughout Kevin Garnett's tenure, the Wolves never acquired a guy who had recently made an All-Star team. D'Lo's a year removed. I mean, it was the 2018 game, not the 2019 game when they acquired him. I said that wrong. 2019 game, not 2020. So now the Wolves have two guys who are a year removed from being All-Stars, but that's the closest thing they've had to acquiring a second All-Star. And both D'Lo and Karl Anthony Towns are so young that it's very likely both of them make another team, at least one, hopefully. So I think that is close to making the list already for that reason alone. However, it doesn't quite make the list. The other, and I did this a little out of order, but I guess the rookies of the year for both Towns and Andrew Wiggins would be close just because at the time it was a really big deal and the sky seemed to be the limit. Clearly that didn't work out for Andrew Wiggins. Karl Anthony Towns at least made two All-Star games and potentially would have made a third this year had it not been for injuries. So it's tough to put that on the list. However, it's close. All right, next we're going to get right into the top five, ranking them in order from five down to one. Before we do that, wanted to mention our good friends at Postmates. From an early morning breakfast burrito to a 12-pack of beers while you watch the game, sometimes you just need what you need delivered fast, and that's where Postmates comes in. If you're like me, you probably start thinking about what to eat for dinner while you're eating lunch. I love food, and that's why I love using Postmates. They deliver food from every restaurant I can think of right to my door. But Postmates doesn't just deliver burgers and sushi. They actually make my life easier with grocery delivery and whatever I can think of delivery to. Convenience stores, clothing stores, you name it. So no more trips to the store, no more late night fast food runs. I don't even have to worry about where to grab lunch anymore. Just download Postmates on iOS or Android, find your favorites, and get anything you want delivered within the hour. For a limited time, Postmates is giving our listeners $100 of free delivery credit for your first 7 days. To start your free deliveries, download the app and use code LOCKEDONNBA. That's code LOCKEDONNBA for $100 of free delivery credit with no minimum purchase for your first 7 days when you download the Postmates app. Anything you need, anytime you need it, Postmate it. All right, let's jump into our top five off-the-court moments in Timberwolves history. Number five, Ricky Rubio's arrival in Minneapolis. So Ricky Rubio, of course, was drafted fifth overall in 2009 and was one of the two players the Wolves took directly in front of Steph Curry. So in that sense, the Rubio acquisition wasn't great. However, pretty universally, it's agreed that the Wolves should have taken Rubio and Steph Curry and not Rubio and Johnny Flynn. The Wolves, of course, picked Rubio fifth overall in 2009 and perhaps he would have come over sooner rather than later, and perhaps he was put off a little bit by Johnny Flynn also being drafted. But Ricky Rubio had a pretty good situation in Europe where he'd been playing professionally since he was 14 years old. He had a hefty buyout with his club in Europe. He had a good situation in Europe, was on a good team, and obviously was comfortable playing there. Quite possibly there was some posturing from his agent trying to get the Timberwolves to move Ricky Rubio to a larger market. That was kind of the narrative at the time, and perhaps that was put out there by his agent, although Rubio said he didn't really care that much. But obviously his agent at the time was interested in Rubio playing in a bigger market as an international, potentially an international star. And then also there's the issue of Johnny Flynn, and there wasn't, the Wolves weren't just going to hand a starting point guard spot to Ricky Rubio. So finally, 2 years after him being drafted in 2009, right during really the NBA lockout in 2011 to 12 that shortened the season to 60 some games, Rubio came over. He, you know, walked through the airport. There was the big airport scene, David Kahn walking with Ricky Rubio and just throngs of Timberwolves fans welcoming him. And it really felt at the moment, this was the guy Wolves fans had waited for 2 years. And if you don't remember the feeling surrounding the 2009 draft, Rubio was supposedly there was this movement that he was going to be Pete Maravich. He was going to be, you know, just this like flamboyant passer who is going to be, you know, passing off his elbow like Jason Williams and like doing all this crazy stuff. And also he had scored a little bit in Europe. So there was some optimism that he could score in the NBA with some craftiness, et cetera. Although there were concerns about his jump shot. As it turns out, of course, he was not quite a superstar, still hasn't been a superstar, but has probably defied expectations, at least from what it looked like in his second year in the league, when after he had dealt with the ACL injury his first year. But actually rewinding a little bit further, the first game he played was against the Miami Heat at home at Target Center, and he electrified the crowd, helped lead the Wolves to a comeback against, obviously, a really good Miami Heat team, had the between the legs pass to Anthony Tolliver in the corner. And there were just a number of these plays, bounce passes in transition that Wolves fans hadn't seen. And honestly, some of that actually disappeared from Rubio as his career in the NBA went on. But the fit between Ricky Rubio and Rick Adelman as coach was amazing. Of course, Rick Adelman had coached Jason Williams and Mike Bibby in Sacramento, who were two a little bit more creative point guards, Williams being the more creative of the two. But there was the offense that Adelman had, Kevin Love, Ricky Rubio, all of that together, kind of, there was this culmination of really like a lot of excitement, and the Wolves were in the playoff hunt until Rubio tore his ACL that year. And things didn't turn out quite as anyone would have hoped, but that moment of arrival was yet another, hey, the Wolves are on the map. They got their guy, you know, the national media Bill Simmons, whoever, said Rubio's never going to play in Minnesota. And here he is. He's in the Minneapolis airport and he's going to play for the Timberwolves. And I think all of those things together make this number five on the list. The number four moment on this list is actually kind of hard to rank. It involves Glenn Taylor purchasing the team back in the mid-90s. I think by some measures, he has not been a great owner, given some of the issues, the Joe Smith under the table contract signing, some of the Kevin Garnett negotiations, of course, some of the coaching hires, maybe the premature firing of Dwayne Casey, which wasn't all him. Of course, Kevin McHale was still with the Wolves at the time. And then the of course, the handling of the Kevin Garnett situation after he was traded the first time, and then, you know, some of the handling of Andrew Wiggins situation. There's been a lot of things recently that have not been great. However, he's been one of the longer tenured owners in the NBA and has been chairman of the Board of Governors for a while, and is well thought of, at least in the league front office, is the word. But his first act as Timberwolves owner was actually a huge deal. He was, of course, a Minnesota native, purchasing the Timberwolves to keep them in Minnesota. The original owners of the Timberwolves were actually willing and motivated to move the team to any number of other owners that would move the team to a different city. There was an issue with the mortgage on the Target Center in the mid-90s, and there was a legitimate chance that they were going to move. There were other cities, including New Orleans, which of course eventually got a team, Nashville, San Diego. Eventually, New Orleans became the place that looked like they were going to try and get the Timberwolves from Minnesota. Glenn Taylor swooped in, however, kept the franchise in his home state. And well, of course, the Wolves have won two playoff series in like the last, 25 years? Or I guess 15 years, but it's been 15 years since they did that. But then two playoff series in the 31 years of the franchise. By that measure, you know, Taylor's not the best owner. And of course, there's all the issues I just listed. But the fact that he bought the Wolves and kept them in Minnesota matters. And that means that that belongs on this list. And of course, for Timberwolves fans who want to see Kevin Garnett's jersey retired at some point in the near future, it'd probably be better if Glenn Taylor were to sell the team soon. Of course, he had looked to do that just a few years ago, actually just prior to the Flip Saunders coming back on board with the Wolves. Taylor was seriously considering selling the team and was starting to sell off minority stakes into the team, but chose to then retain the majority ownership and now appears to have flipped and doesn't want to be selling the team anytime soon, which of course also means that Kevin Garnett won't be getting his number 21 jersey retired anytime soon. The number three moment is a much happier moment, an easier moment to rank. That's Kevin Garnett's rearrival to the Timberwolves after his acquisition from the Brooklyn Nets. Flip Saunders, less than a year after coming back to the Wolves in the front office, he traded Thaddeus Young to the Brooklyn Nets to get a 38-year-old Kevin Garnett. From a basketball perspective, it didn't make a ton of sense. Thaddeus Young was a legit, good, kind of fourth option, a guy who could play multiple positions, guard multiple positions, wasn't quite the shooter that was ideal, but was just a kind of a do-it-all type guy. But off the court and less tangibly, reacquiring the best player in franchise history made a lot of sense to Saunders. It energized Target Center. It energized the Wolves fan base. It was the first step in what should have been patching things up between Kevin Garnett, Glenn Taylor, and the Wolves franchise at large. And also, Garnett, of course, has this reputation of being an insanely hard worker and being maniacally focused. And the Wolves thought that that was the type of example that could be set for, at the time, a rookie Andrew Wiggins. The Wolves didn't know this yet, but they were going to get the first pick and get Karl-Anthony Towns. And, you know, the way that aligned, to have Towns mentor Kevin Garnett, Garnett mentor Karl-Anthony Towns, and Saunders also brought in Tayshaun Prince to help with Andrew Wiggins, Andre Miller to help with Ricky Rubio, and kind of had this whole mentorship program going on. It, of course, didn't lead to wins on the court, and maybe it was a little bit misguided in some ways, but reacquiring Kevin Garnett, it was tough to find someone that was legitimately upset about this move. And there's still a video, it's still on YouTube, actually, Garnett's, the introductions and all that when Garnett was reintroduced to Target Center. There was recently an article, I think it was in an article at The Athletic, talking to the game entertainment, game presentation person who put together essentially the hype video just for Garnett. The Wolves had a hype video introducing the other four starters per usual that night, and then one just dedicated to Kevin Garnett and his career in a Wolves uniform. And the reintroduction, the Garnett banging his head on the stanchion, the salute to Jiggly Boy, the fan in the stands with his chest painted, the emotion from Garnett. It was just an amazing moment for Timberwolves fans, for people who grew up watching Kevin Garnett play for the Wolves, watching him drag this team to the conference finals, win the MVP, to see him come back and step on the court for a team that had really been a woebegone franchise since he'd left, which is a span of, he'd been gone for 8 or 9 years at that point. They hadn't been to the playoffs in 11 or 12 years at that point. Just a massive moment in Timberwolves history. And unfortunately, what should have been him riding off into the sunset, eventually becoming a part owner with Glenn Taylor, that all fell apart when Flip Saunders tragically passed away about a year and a half after that. And things unraveled extremely quickly, as there was no longer that bridge between Garnett and Glenn Taylor. And unfortunately, there's this weird parallel between those number three and four moments on this list, where neither of them have quite turned out as hopefully as they were at the time. But at any rate, Garnett's reintroduction to the Target Center crowd hits number three on this list. Next up, we're going to talk number two and number one on the list of the best off-the-court moments in Timberwolves history. All right, the number two off-the-court moment in Wolves history. Kevin Garnett wins the 2003-2004 NBA MVP award. And that was another one of those putting the Timberwolves on the map moments. By the time everybody knew that he was getting the award, the Wolves were well into their playoff run, and it was easily, by far, the best playoff run in Wolves history, given that it was the only year they won any playoff series, and they won two as the top seed in the Western Conference. But his regular season was amazing by any measure. He actually received 120 of 123 possible first place votes for the MVP that year, and finally received the recognition nationally. Locally, people had been calling him the best player on the planet, and sure, that was, you know, arguable at different times, but he was certainly a top five player for a stretch, of 2 or 3 years there in the early 2000s. And this year, by any measure, he was amazing. If you look at his per game, his counting stats, he averaged 24.2 points, 13.9 rebounds, and even 5 assists, 2.2 blocks, and a steal and a half per game, led the Wolves to 58 wins, the top seed, a berth in the conference finals after never having won a playoff series in franchise history. If you look at any other metric, go to Basketball Reference, look at the 2003-2004 campaign, look at the league leaders, scroll down to any of the advanced metrics, and Garnett dominates every category. He's number one in overall win shares. It's not close. He's 4.8 win shares ahead of Peja Stojakovic. He's a 5.2 win shares ahead of Tim Duncan. Sam Cassell is actually fourth in the league that year. Win shares per 48 minutes. He's the easy leader. Tim Duncan was second. Box score plus minus, number one, not close. Offensive box score plus minus, number two. Defensive box plus minus, number one. Value of a replacement player or VORP, he's the easy number one there. Defensive win shares, he's second. Offensive win shares, he's second. So combined, he's an easy first because he was a close second in both those categories. Garnett dominated on both ends of the floor that season and was easily the best player on the Western Conference's best team and really the league's best team that season. The Pacers won 61 games in a much weaker East, but the Wolves, and then of course, Sam Cassell's injury in the playoffs derailed their playoff run. They lost in the conference finals to the Lakers in 6 games, but Garnett had just an unbelievable season. And again, another put Minnesota on the map moment, another Garnett gets the recognition and the due that he deserves moment as the Wolves enjoyed Kevin Garnett winning his only MVP award in the 2003-2004 season. The top moment, and this is, I guess it feels a little bit like a cop-out, but it also feels like something we can't ignore, was drafting Kevin Garnett in 1995. At the time, this was kind of a stick-your-neck-out-there type of a move by both Kevin McHale and Flip Saunders, who were in the Wolves front office at the time. Saunders was not the coach yet, but he was working with McHale in the front office. And of course, there's all those stories about them going to watch him in a gym in Chicago and basically saying, we can't tell anybody what we just saw. This is the guy we want. He was only 18 years old. He had some minor off the court problems, gotten into a fight or something when he had transferred. He grew up in South Carolina, moved to Chicago, went to Farragut Academy in Chicago, had just some minor off the court issues. He was also 18 and players weren't successfully jumping to the NBA out of high school and really nobody was doing it at all. And the Wolves decided to take a risk, and a franchise that hadn't made the playoffs yet took Kevin Garnett fifth overall in that draft. And of course the rest is history. And not only was that a huge move for the Timberwolves, and obviously it was, But that also started the movement of high school players coming to the NBA. Shortly thereafter, Kobe Bryant, Tracy McGrady, a number of players who did it unsuccessfully, but plenty of other superstars that made that same jump. And Garnett was the guy that started it all. The Timberwolves were the team that started it all by sticking their necks out and saying, this is the guy we want. He's going to be a superstar. And sure enough, it only took him a season to get there. His 19-year-old season as a rookie, he played 29 minutes a game, averaged 10-6, was good for a non-playoff team. The following year, the Wolves made the playoffs for the first time. 20-year-old Kevin Garnett made the All-Star team. He only missed the All-Star team two times in his career until he was 37 years old. And one was when he was 35 with the Celtics. He took a year off there. And then the other was a lockout shortened season in 98-99. Every other year, he was an All-Star. He played basically 80 games every year. And it all traces back to that decision to draft him fifth overall in what was really a controversial pick back in 1995. Looking at the other guys drafted, that was the draft when Joe Smith was picked number one overall, which of course ends up being a little bit ironic given his connection to the Timberwolves and the under-the-table deal the Wolves executed to try and keep Smith on a contract, which cost the Wolves several first-round picks and some fines as well. Antonio McDyess went second in that draft. Jerry Stackhouse went third. Rasheed Wallace went fourth. Of course, all those guys were solid pros, and there were a couple All-Star games mixed in there with those guys too. Kevin Garnett to the Wolves at fifth, ahead of Bryant Reeves out of Oklahoma State at six, who had a short career but was seen as an easy lottery pick at the time. Damon Stoudemire, Sean Respert, Ed O'Bannon, Kurt Thomas, Gary Trent went 11th. Things went really kind of downhill in that draft with the only other real stars that got picked later on. Michael Finley went 21. So it ended up not being a very deep draft at all. And so the decision at five was maybe, it was controversial in that it was a high school player and he was the only high school guy drafted in that first round that year. Everybody else was a collegiate player, and the Wolves said, instead of taking the college center, Bryant Reeves, instead of taking the guard, Damon Stoudemire, we're going to take the big man who's 18 and completely raw. And as it turned out, he played 21 seasons, won an MVP, led the Wolves to the conference finals, won a championship with the Celtics, and is one of the probably best 20 players of all time. So drafting Garnett fifth overall at 1995 was definitely the number one moment on our list. All right, that's all we have for you today. Thanks once again for listening to the Locked On Wolves podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network. Remember, the Locked On Network is your local experts on the biggest stories. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, Google, wherever you get your podcasts. Follow us on Twitter at Locked On T-Wolves. That's at Locked On T-Wolves. Don't forget the T. That wraps up this edition of Locked On Wolves. Now, tell your smart device to play the most recent episode of Locked On Fantasy Basketball. Once again, I'm Ben Beacon. This is the Locked On Wolves podcast, and we'll catch you next time.